I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Like nothing we've known or imagined, COVID-19, the novel virus, has arrived. The invisible bug that feeds on human lung tissue. The coronavirus. The omnidirectional killer and crisis that could feel, somebody said, more like a tsunami hitting than a war breaking out. It's a successor to epidemics like the modern Ebola and the ancient bubonic plagues. Its global spread has been formally designated this week a pandemic, but almost all the rest of the coronavirus narrative is yet to be told. We take advantage this hour of a world-famous concentration of medical talent in the Boston neighborhood, at the forefront of research, teaching, and practice, and public health as well. Arthur Kleinman gets us started, teacher of teachers, MD psychiatrist with years, decades of experience in China, author of 40 soulful books, and an anthropologist to boot, with an eye on the subtler social effects of a plague. Arthur Kleinman, welcome back to this program. Why do we find ourselves so helpless?
Well, this is, first of all, a real crisis. We're seeing something that's not fake and not exaggerated, but is real. And we've had inappropriate preparation for this. We've had a government that I think has played down the problem so that all of a sudden it manifested itself in a way that has scared the pants off of people. And the time we've had to prepare, the months that China has been facing this and Korea, and more recently Europe, we sort of lost the advantage we had of we didn't get the testing done. We don't have the information and the knowledge that is important, and we're all waiting to see what happens. And I think, you know, in one hand, as a medical issue, this is going to be a story of how politics interfered with science. But as a human story, this is going to be recognition of the fact that we live with uncertainty and with danger all the time. And this is just an extraordinary example of it. And I think it'll clarify human experience better than almost anything else we've had. But that's not what you people want to hear, because we all want to feel that this nervousness, this fear that we have, can be allayed by knowledge in some way. And I think it can.
We want to hear what you know, Arthur Kleinman. Would you just plunge into the pretty grisly news from Italy?
Yeah.
A nightmare. There's a modern country with superior medicine, we understood, and they say every corridor in every hospital is an intensive care unit, short of ventilators, short of everything.
Right. And so that's exactly what happened in China, and it happened in South Korea. It's happening right now in Italy, and this is what we fear could happen in the United States. And that is, in Italy, our colleagues are saying that about 10% of the cases they're seeing of coronavirus need some sort of hospitalization. Mm. And then some percentage of those need intensive care to respond to respiratory failure, to shock and other conditions. And they simply don't have the beds, don't have the intensive care units, don't have all the ventilators they need. So they're faced with fundamental ethical questions about who do you treat first.
Absolutely. This is the triage question in war, and it's a profound moral choice. Who's going to get treated? Who's going to get saved? Who's going to die?
And this is the difference between, you know, war and also a pandemic, an acute pandemic setting, and what is everyday life. In everyday life, you give the available instruments, the intubate and use the respirator for people who have the most serious problem. But in a setting like the Italians are in, and hopefully this will not be the setting we're in, but it could be, you're going to have to make a decision, and that decision is going to be based on who seems to be more survivable, who has a better chance of making it through.
And who decides?
Yeah, and who decides? It's going to be those decisions are going to be made on the run, very, very fast, in settings of confusion and uncertainty in hospital corridors.
Arthur, to me, the scariest thing in Italy is the confirmation of what we learned in high school, the incredible power of exponential growth. 2 weeks ago, Italy had, 322 confirmed cases. 1 week ago, they had 2,500. Today, they have 10,000 cases. How do we deal with that spike?
Yeah, well, the so that's what, you know, our great concern is here. How to, as Tony Fauci put it, how to push down the curve so that we have smaller numbers of cases occurring over a longer period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And central to that is knowledge of what we're facing. Where are the cases? Where are the clusters? What are the numbers?
Mm-hmm.
And to figure that out, you've got to test. And this, I'd say, has been a fundamental failure of the government, and a surprising one, because the CDC is one of the world's leading organizations in public health, and yet somehow it managed to make a mess of the testing situation.
Mm.
You have other guests who can speak more specifically to this, but I find myself very, very surprised by that, and I think that when we learn the reasons for this, they're going to turn on politics. The fact that the Trump administration seems to be unwilling to face facts that are negative in any way, and wants to always paint a rosy picture of things,
right?
It's scary. Has somehow intervened there.
It's scary when we feel we know more than the President of the United States. But then the government, praise God, speaks in many voices. And you mentioned Anthony Fauci. I mean, there's an emerging hero who has been very, very straight ahead at great risk to himself over the years in calling a disease a disease.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, Tony's been there for a long time. There seems to be a lack of, however, of a central organized representation of who's in charge, what's being done, and what will be done. And I think that the president has been an absolute failure in this regard. The vice president doesn't do a hell of a lot better. And this is also an administration that has been anti-science, has cut back on public health. And so what we really need is to have someone like Tony take charge, to have someone clearly in charge here.
Right. Well, he is de facto, is he not? And everybody swears by him.
There are multiple people in charge right now, and I think that that's what's confusing. There's some very good people who are involved, but I think that they're having difficulty expressing a single point of view that's based on what we know, and rather they're being interfered with, and that's how I see it, by a political process that has wanted until perhaps today to paint a picture that's unrealistic and that is, as the president said, everything will eventually be good and go away.
Yeah.
Well, it's not going to be that way. We're going to live through this. We are going to get through this, but these are going to be, they're going to be tough days. And in order to be able to face up to those days and do the right things and get on top of the situation, we really need a combination of information and clear messaging and authority. And
you're giving us a start of it, Arthur, but I'd love you to speak from your experience in China. Would you have expected China's turn? They hesitated, and then they went tough.
China, I think we have to see two different realities. The first reality is that they had a massive failure at the very beginning. They could have, within the first weeks, controlled this virus locally had they paid attention to the concern of local doctors that it was all coming from a particular market, that there were multiple cases and that something had to be done. That was played down by local authorities in the communist system. No one wants to pass on bad information upstream,
right,
because you get whacked on the hands if you do that. And so that was China's failure. But having failed at that, I think, they took incredible steps and remarkably I think, have done things that are just possibly impossible in a democratic society, probably largely impossible in a democratic society. They literally shut down cities. They shut down transportation. They controlled whole provinces. And I think that we see that they're having an effect. Now,
right.
I must also say that, you know, we don't have all the data from China. We have some of the data, and some of it is confusing and in conflict. But what we have seen is claims of reduced cases on almost a daily basis now, and a sense that they're getting on top of this. And in the origin city, Wuhan, we see people getting back to their everyday life. And so
it's amazing. But Arthur, I'd love you to note your own hawkishness early on. You would have put Seattle, in effect, in a quarantine before that bug got to Oregon or California. Explain that.
Yeah, I think that had they started right then and there with a radius, I don't know, public health experts could have given a specific radius of how many blocks you had to have around this market. They could have controlled the number of cases and the initial transmission of the infection. So the infection is, you know, COVID-19 is the name of the disease, not the virus. The virus is SARS-CoV-2. It's one of the coronaviruses. They did a great job in identifying the virus early, and I think that was a real contribution. But then there was an absence of, and not just an absence, but a cover up of how big the spread was, and what its implications were. And it was actually, if you think about it, the failure continued right into Chinese New Year, because 5 million people in that city of 11 million left Wuhan, and there went your ability to control things. From the first case, 30 days it took for this virus to spread throughout China.
Hold it there, Arthur Kleinman. Coming up, coronavirus before and after. What's to remember here, and what's to expect? This is Open Source. Coronavirus question time this hour with the doctor's doctors. Arthur Kleinman is our psychiatrist. Megan Murray is our infectious disease clinician. David Jones is our historian, all of them in different branches of the Harvard Medical School. Megan's at the School of Public Health as well. Your specialty, Megan Murray, I read, is transmission dynamics of different diseases. On millions of minds, I think, the question is, how we could pick up the coronavirus and transmit it to others before we showed symptoms or knew that we had it.
Yeah, so the virus has an incubation period that we think is on the average of about 5 days. Mm-hmm. But people start to shed virus in their respiratory tract a couple of days before that incubation period. So that means that before they're actually sick, they can be infectious. And that's true of a number of other infectious diseases. Chickenpox, for example, is mostly spread before it's diagnosed. Mm. So, you know, what that means is it's much more difficult to control transmission simply by finding people who are sick and isolating them. And that will control a lot of transmission. So we think after the person has become sick, they're probably shed virus for another up to 10 days, so a total of about 2 weeks. But those first 2 to 5 days, they're probably not presenting to a doctor, and so they're not getting diagnosed, not getting put into isolation, not quarantining themselves unless they know they've been exposed. And during that time, they're making their usual social contact, so they're able to transmit the disease. If we do good isolation, which is not all that easy, that means putting someone in a unit where they can't transmit to another. Hmm. That might be a critical care, you know, an ICU, but it might also, they might not be sick enough to be in an ICU. But we also have to do that because they stay infectious for another fairly long period of time.
Megan Murray, I wish you'd coach us on the numbers. the general number we hear of 40 to 60, or roughly 50% of populations getting exposed, and then calculate the death rate on that number, it's too scary even to write down. What do we believe about the dangers out of the numbers?
So it's really hard to say. We're estimating that 50%, you know, somewhere between 40 and 70% of the population, the world's population, could be infected based on something called the basic reproductive number. And that is a kind of a hypothetical that says that if you took a single infectious person and put them in a completely susceptible population, how many people would that single infectious person infect? And so that varies for different infections. Some are super infectious, measles, for example. And this virus is modestly infectious. So on average, we think it affects, you know, probably about two people, a little bit more than two people. But that means for every person who infects two people, you're going to see exponential growth.
Mm-hmm.
And if there are no interventions that are successful, so no social distancing and no isolation, then what stops an epidemic is the accumulation of people who are immune. And so you have enough people in the population that have already had the disease that they're kind of blocking transmission, because you tend to meet the people that you meet are people who have already been infected. And so if you leave it to run its course without doing anything, an organism that has a basic reproductive number of around 2 or 2.3 will eventually, you know, mathematically infect about half the world's population.
Mm.
If we do things, we can really reduce that reproductive number. And so those things at the moment are isolating people during their infectious period, quarantining people so that we catch them early. And quarantine means finding people who've been exposed, but we haven't yet diagnosed because they haven't yet developed either symptoms or viral shedding. But then keeping them somewhere until they develop symptoms, or the kind of social distancing that we're talking about now, which is, you know, it's closing schools, trying to keep people from going to work, and in its most extreme form, a lockdown.
Megan, I want to ask you a tough question that originated for me with Mike Davis, California writer, always provocative, and he notes online the inequality here. The casualties will not be spread evenly around the world's populations. He says the danger to the global poor has been almost totally ignored by journalism and the Western governments. The only certainty in our world is that rich countries and rich classes will focus on saving themselves to the exclusion of international solidarity and medical aid, which is to say, we stand for walls, not vaccines, in the wider world. He asks, could there be a more evil template for the future?
Yeah, well, we aren't talking enough about low and middle-income countries, partly because we're very fixated about our own problems at the moment, and partly because Africa and South America are late to the party, if you want to put it that way. And they're probably late to the party because there's not as much air travel and mobility from Asia, although there is quite a lot, and possibly because of weather. But that will change. I mean, almost every country has now reported some cases. That's lower in Africa, but it's almost certainly the case that that's partly due to lack of testing. So one more thing we know is that you know, we've seen what's happened in Italy. The U.S. has a lot more intensive care unit beds per 100,000 population than Italy does, but many of them are filled. But one thing we really do know is that poor countries have very, very few intensive care unit beds and very, very little capacity to absorb this kind of surge, where people are talking about surge capacity, meaning
right. The
numbers of really very ill people who will need, very intensive and expensive care. It's just not available, and so it's going to be much harder than say getting HIV drugs to Africa. It means getting ventilators and intensive care units and staff to places where they don't exist right now.
Go back to the testing question. Simply, why Tom Hanks could get tested and was, and his wife, in Australia, but wouldn't have qualified for a test in the Massachusetts General Hospital.
Yeah, well, it's a mystery. As Arthur said, the CDC has been a really strong public health organization for decades, centuries perhaps. And so this failure is really hard to understand. There was a test that the WHO had and was using in other countries in the world, but the CDC decided to create their own. One of the problems with the test that's been used in some of the other countries is it's not particularly sensitive, meaning that it gives you a misdiagnosis a fair amount of the time. And I think the CDC was trying to improve on that. Mm. But what happened was they sent out kits that they thought would work, and there was something wrong with them. There was what they said was a faulty reagent in them. And so they took that back to the drawing board, but they tried to fix that. That lost a serious amount of time. And even now, I really don't understand the production problem, but people who are presenting with mild respiratory syndromes colds or flu-like syndromes in Boston are not qualifying for testing, which is really, means that those people can't be identified and quarantined, and their contacts can't be quarantined.
Is it true that I hear something like a decade ago, the coronavirus was known, but the drive for a vaccine was abandoned?
So the first SARS, which happened in 2002-2003, was also a coronavirus that's quite similar to this one, although not identical. And after that mostly occurred in China. There was a spillover to other countries, but it was rapidly controlled, meaning months, but through interventions. But at the time, that led to a lot of work on trying to develop a vaccine and therapies. And I think that work has really led to the fact that the vaccines, there are vaccine candidates already that are ready to go into human trials. Hmm. I think had that not happened, that work for the past 18 years, that we couldn't possibly be getting vaccine candidates within weeks of identifying the SARS-2 organism.
Megan Murray, stand by. I want to introduce.
Can I just jump in on that SARS
please.
Issue?
Sure.
Because I studied SARS in China, and I think the beginning was quite different. When the SARS epidemic began in China and in Hong Kong, there was a sense that the mortality rate, the case fatality rate, could have been as high as 30-50%.
Wow.
With the emphasis on what was happening to medical staff. I remember the great hero in Hong Kong of that epidemic was Joseph Sung at the Prince of Wales Hospital, who divided his staff into thirds and say, one third of us will serve here and we'll probably die. One third will come later and replace us, and one third will stay home and will continue our medical school after we're gone. And so that was a very scary moment. And then, of course, at the end, we learned that the actual rate of mortality was 10%, which is a fearsome rate, but nothing like what was originally thought to have been there. But clearly, that virus must have had different dynamics in terms of its transmissibility, because it did not produce the same kinds of transmission as we've seen with this coronavirus.
Important point, including the heroic doctoring there, Arthur Kleinman. I want to introduce David Jones. He trained as a doctor in pediatrics and psychiatry before he turned to history and culture of science and technology. He's a voluminous writer about Native American mortality since 1600, for example, also a history of cardiac care. And you published today in the New England Journal of Medicine, David, a piece, a wonderfully interesting piece on history's lessons for COVID-19. Can you spell them out?
Yeah, I'll try to summarize that. You said at the outset of the show that one of the things that is so frightening about this epidemic is that it feels new. People talk about the novel coronavirus that is striking us.
Right.
And certainly American society has never recently seen disruptions of the sort that we're seeing this week. But epidemics themselves are not new. As long as humans have been living in cities, going back thousands of years, we have records of epidemics and how societies have responded to these epidemics. And we can learn a tremendous amount from this history that's useful for trying to guide our reactions to this problem today.
Well, you say a lot of the reactions have been the same century after century after century, and maybe this year.
Yeah, and it's uncanny to see the parallels as they play out. And so the typical thing that happens with an epidemic is there's an initial small series of cases. There are subtle clues that sometimes get noticed and sometimes don't get noticed.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, because of the exponential growth, the epidemic builds a momentum that it forces itself to be recognized, often reluctantly, whether it's a conscious problem or an unconscious problem. Societies are often very slow to recognize the problem that they face. And you could see that in China in December and January, and I think you've seen that in the United States over the past month.
You saw it classically in Camus' plague in North Africa.
Yeah, and it's
just
ironic.
Deny, forget it. You didn't see the rats. You're not missing anybody.
No, exactly. And one of the best descriptions of how a society responds isn't a work of history. It's a work of philosophy and fiction. But Camus really had an uncanny sense of these dynamics of how societies respond to the crisis that an epidemic presents. Once it's recognized, then society demands explanation. People want to know what's happening and why it's happening. And in this case, the Chinese did a remarkably good job identifying the mechanistic part of this. Hmm. They identified the virus. They sequenced the virus. That was made clear. But that's never the full explanation. People always want to know, why did this happen?
Hmm.
And there are all the discussions about these Chinese meat markets. Who is to blame? And the blame dynamic has been a part of every epidemic response. And it rarely produces anything useful. And it's been very disappointing to see how blame has played out here. And you could even see it in Trump's talk last night. He talked about the foreign virus.
Right.
Introduced to us by China, and it was introduced to us by the Europeans.
After a first stage of sort of playing the whole thing down, you know, what virus, ignoring it, that pattern, then blaming somebody, where does it go from there?
And so what you ideally want to have happen, there are two outcomes. One, as Megan had described, is that left to their own devices, most epidemics will run their course on their own as the population of susceptible people dies. What you hope will happen is that human societies will figure out a way to respond productively, either to flatten the curve, to decrease the case fatality rates that we're experiencing.
What does that mean, flatten the curve?
So as epidemics go through a characteristic pattern of a rise and fall, driven by the exponential growth as the pathogen moves into a population of susceptible people, and then it will fall either as it loses those susceptible people or society finds a way to respond proactively and effectively against it. And one of the things that's so interesting about epidemics, because societies have been dealing with these for thousands of years, some of the best techniques are really ancient techniques. The thing that has worked so well in part in China and South Korea has been quarantine. Quarantine is a 14th century technology, if not older. People have long had intuitions that you can manage these epidemics by isolating people who are infected and trying to contain their spread. Everyone hopes that this epidemic will eventually be solved with a modern technology, with an immunization, or with antiviral treatment. But until we have those things, it's very old technologies and very old practices that are going to be the mainstay of how we respond to this epidemic.
You also, I'd love you to explain the denialist impulse, ancient and maybe universal. What drives it? And then how do you break it? How does a society break it?
So there are different things. And again, the I don't want to go too far as a psychiatrist into this. And you can try to psychoanalyze.
Yeah,
past
please
people.
Go for it.
But there are two things that really do seem to drive it most often. One is economic interest or economic self-interest. As we are now seeing, as we watch the Dow Jones plummet every day, epidemics can be catastrophically bad for the economy. If you have an economy that's built on commerce, on free trade, anything that disrupts that will have a bad impact on the economy. And so historically, whenever societies have started to fear that an epidemic is brewing, they immediately then fear the economic consequences that will follow from that. And that, I think, drives a lot of the denial. But there's also, I think, a psychological component to it, that we all like our lives to continue as business as usual. We don't want them to be disruptive in totally chaotic ways. I have many students at Harvard College who had just turned in their senior theses, and they had a wonderful spring to look forward to before graduation, and that has now been totally taken away from them by the response to this epidemic. And so again, if in these early stages of the epidemic, before it becomes unavoidable to acknowledge, we want to preserve our reassurance, our familiar life as much as we can. And that desire of psychological comfort, I think, plays a strong role in the denial.
Fascinating, David. When we come back, maybe I'll ask you if that's what drives Sean Hannity to call it a hoax, or Rush Limbaugh to call it, you know, the common cold. Coming up, is it true that everyone's a socialist in a pandemic? This is Open Source. The question about coronavirus comes to, does a pandemic have a political logic inside it, or political implication? Could the coronavirus deliver a revolution? Could it be nature's way of reforming healthcare delivery, as straight politics often doesn't deliver? Arthur Kleinman, would you take a crack at the denialist question? What is that impulse?
Apparently, well, you know, everywhere. We heard from David, I think, two very good points. One, that there's an economic denial, and two, a psychological denial. And you could say the third is a denial of government, that whether the government is socialist or whether it's capitalist, that bad news and negative things don't appeal politically, and you play them down. But I think that it's there's a risk of being too simplistic about this. And I think the idea that somehow epidemics make us communal, make us socialist, is not necessarily at all the case. I think you can find as much evidence for the fact that you can also get an everyone for themselves, every person for themselves kind of response, a libertarian sort of response as well. People diving for cover, getting out of the way, so that there are multiple responses, one of the great ones that we should appreciate is how first responders, doctors and nurses, are out there on the line, putting their life on the line.
Amen.
And I think that is we take that in a sense for granted. That's part of the calling, as it will. But we should recognize it, and we should applaud it, and we should support it. And I think that along with that, we see something that I find quite remarkable in our society, which was the emphasis not just by Trump and the administration, but actually by the newspapers as well, the media, on the economics right from the word go, demonstrating, I think, in our society how economic issues have become, or an economic language has become, the defining language to look at any sort of threat or concern.
What are you speaking about other than the Dow Jones average and that, you know, oh, wow, this has got to be serious. Look at that. Look at the
Yeah,
market.
Well, I think it's got first of all, the stocks fell, and everyone is concerned for what's the implication for that for the economy. But I think we should begin with something else. That the realization at this point should be, look at our concern. Our concern is about the threat to health and the importance of public health and care. We should recognize that at this existential moment, when the society has almost stopped and everyone is thinking about what to do, that the we're in this this setting of realization of how important things that we take for granted are, our health and care. Care is what keeps our society together, and when it comes down to it, health is of enormous importance, of importance greater than economics, politics, just about everything else. That's why, it seems to me, this is exactly the moment for people to make the case for supporting public health and supporting a healthcare system. When we have to face, shortly, the reality of increasing numbers of cases that are hospitalized in intensive care units, the difference between who survives and who lives is the quality of care in those units, the availability of technology, and the skills of practitioners, of doctors and nurses. Mm. And again, this is the moment to recognize how centrally important that is and how we must invest in that, that this is something that is just as important, if not more important, than the economic matters that we seem to be focused on all the time.
Extend that, Megan Murray, if you will. I mean, Arthur says it doesn't make us socialists, but it should wake us up to public health. You teach both public health and doctor medicine. Explain that border.
Well, it's, you know, I tend to try to blur that line, although that's not the norm. One of the things that prevents transmission is treating patients, and I think that that's often lost. So I work a lot on tuberculosis, and one of the best ways to prevent TB patients from spreading their TB is to treat them, is to find them and treat them. I think sometimes we see a tension between public health and medical practice where we think, okay, are we going to invest in things like vaccinations, which I think everybody agrees we should, well, obviously not everybody, but most medical professionals and public health professionals agree that we should invest in those. But there's sometimes a trade-off between, an almost utilitarian trade-off between how can we achieve the most benefit for the least cost. And the reality is that intensive care units and really high standards, high quality medical care is not inexpensive. But I think that it often is closely aligned with public health. That providing excellent medical care can be the same, have the same, achieve the same kinds of things that the public health world wants to achieve through a different kinds of interventions, population-based interventions. So, you know, I'd like to think that the way we approach an epidemic like this is that there's no conflict between providing excellent care and making sure other people aren't infected. So putting people in intensive care units, providing isolation, making sure our healthcare workers are both protected themselves from being infected and able to provide good care is going to achieve both those purposes, both reducing the fatality rate in people who already have disease and hopefully preventing further spread of disease.
We've got to come back to that because we're in the middle of a political debate on the Democratic primary level, certainly, about radical reform of the whole medical industry, dare I say. David Jones, I wish you'd take us back sort of the longest history of our understanding of where these things come from. It seems to me in a more spiritual age than ours, we would assume that some divinity was angry with us. In our world, we seem to come to the general conclusion that that in killing the rainforests and the coral reefs, things like that, we are provoking nature. And at the same time, these plagues go way back before the Industrial Age, before the Anthropocene. What do we know? What do we intuit? What can we learn about where these outbreaks come from, really?
Yeah, so epidemics have always been major crises for the societies that strike them, and they really focus at people's attention on the immediacy of their problem. And people devote a lot of energy to try to understand what has gone wrong. And that has fueled an amazingly creative range of responses and explanations of what epidemics mean, what they represent, where they come from. And you're absolutely right. At different times in different places, people have given very different explanations. Now we're focused on this virus, you know, this little sack of RNA that is causing so much trouble. In the past, people have used spiritual and religious explanations. Those aren't that much a part of the remote past. Into the 19th century, when there were cholera epidemics in the United States, the government responded by holding national days of prayer. Given some of the characters who are in the current administration, I've actually been waiting to see if one of them does do that. I wouldn't be astonished at this point if people call for divine intervention to try to bail us out, given the beliefs and practices of many of our political leaders.
Yeah, it's an old and dangerous game. Jerry Falwell did it with HIV/AIDS. That was God's punishment for homosexuality or something. You don't really want to go too far in
no,
that direction.
But one of the things underlying all of these explanations has long been an intuition, as you suggested a bit ago, that epidemics really are political processes. The people who are at risk are not randomly distributed in society. One of the things that has been clear through so much of history is the people who are most at risk are often the most marginalized, the least resourced, the least powerful people in society. And epidemics often will reveal these fault lines that exist in societies. So when tuberculosis was a huge problem in the United States in the 19th century, most of that mortality was concentrated in the very poor people in society. As Megan had mentioned earlier, you know, if COVID really does go global with significant mortality rates, it would be reasonable to predict that the bulk of that mortality is going to be borne by poor populations, whether it's people in the United States who don't have access to health care or people living in these huge cities in Africa and South Asia and elsewhere who are in relatively compromised health at baseline because of poverty and lack of adequate nutrition, have no reasonable access to healthcare services. That's where I worry that the bulk of the mortality will be concentrated. I mean, yes, we should be worried about what's going to happen in places like Seattle or San Francisco or Boston or New York. But everyone who lives in these cities is blessed not just with access to much better than average healthcare, but with populations that are very well off. Again, not everyone. There are disparities in these cities. But on average, you know, Boston is a relatively wealthy city by global standards.
Of course.
Our population is well off by global standards. That will give us certain advantages going into an epidemic like this. And we need to keep in mind that most of the world's population is much less fortunate, and that political disparity will become clearer, I'm afraid, over the course of this epidemic.
What if it brings global medicine, global consciousness into, you know, its overdue glory? I mean, if there were ever a universal sort of border-jumping disease to demonstrate our equal vulnerability and our tiered, scandalously unequal systems of care, I mean, this is it.
Well, you would hope, as Arthur had pointed out, even though an idealist would say an epidemic would show that we're all in this forever and that solidarity is the best response, I think it is the best response. But historically, that isn't how people have always responded in the past. Many epidemics have been characterized by erecting barriers, by building walls, by trying to block people out. There are a few cases that historians like to fixate on where, you know, people get what they deserve. There was a case in, I think it was either 16th or 17th century in early modern Italy, where plague was in the countryside, and so many towns in Italy closed their gates and were preventing villagers from coming in because they wanted to keep the plague out and protect themselves. And some of the villages in the vicinity of Naples were then hit when Mount Vesuvius erupted. And since all the gates were closed, the citizens couldn't get out of the town, and they suffered catastrophic mortality from the volcanic mud flows.
And we saw things like just like that in China. And this is about stigma. And we'll see stigma also as COVID-19 pandemic increases in the United States. We'll see areas stigmatized, people stigmatized. This seems to happen all the time and contributes to the negative consequences of this kind of problem.
I think that there's an irony here that the people who are in the U.S. who are affected early are travelers. So people who are wealthy enough to be doing international travel and on cruises. And what I think we're going to see over the months that follow is a real shift in who is infected as it, as this starts to be spread in communities. Of course, that's already happening. The kinds of, and this is largely driven by what David was saying is, you know, the increased vulnerability, but also by the increased number of contacts that people have. So if you think about a prison, for example, some of the prisons that I've been to in Africa and South America are so crowded that one can't walk across the room without kind of doing a kind of, you know, a dance with whoever's there to try to get through. It was hundreds of people in very close, you know, in small spaces. And what we know from our work in TB is that the rates of infectious diseases in those kinds of contexts are orders of magnitude higher than the rates in the general population.
Right.
And that's true in all sorts of facilities, you know, facilities for the homeless. We've already seen this in nursing homes. We will see it in hospitals for chronic disease as well.
I wonder what all of you, each of you, think will be the long-term effects, the long-term memories of something could easily be comparable to the 1918 World War I flu. Big things and little things. Effects on children, little children growing up in this era of terrific anxiety, but also on workers, teleworking, people discovering that they're better off working at home alone. I mean, what effects on our character?
Chris, I think that's a great question. It was said in the 2002-2003 SARS epidemic in China that what the Chinese government learned then was that they could mobilize the population, that they were not sure about that they could do that in the same way that they had in the radical Maoist years, that they would be able to do that in the capitalist years. And they proved to themselves they could do that. And you can see that right now in China. And I think that, you know, asking that question is excellent for us. I would hope that one thing that might come out of this, though I suspect this may be a little romantic, would be the recognition that right at this moment, when you think about really what is at stake for you, what really matters, health looms very large. And if it looms large like that, then you have to say, well, you know, let's be careful when we say that things have to be organized by issues of cost containment, that cost is as important as effectiveness of treatment and of prevention.
Now that's a very interesting point, Arthur, that we undervalue our health, the happiness we get from sound bodies.
That life is at stake right now for people. And if life is at stake and the government says we're going to do everything we can to prevent lives from being taken in large numbers, I think there's recognition that investing in life, investing in health, investing in those things that are what every day matters to us is just as important as our concerns for the stock market and for large businesses and everything else. So from my perspective, that would be a great lesson to learn, though I suspect David will tell us that historically it doesn't happen.
An existential choice. What do you think, David?
Well, so one of the things, and it's still too early to tell, is, you know, how bad will this epidemic to be? When I look back at history, I get strange and maybe misplaced reassurance from the fact that epidemics that kill more than a million people are vanishingly rare in human history. And even if you try to take in consideration the fact that the population is much larger now than it used to be, huge mega epidemics just don't happen that often. And so you can say, well, you know, what are the odds that we're in the midst of one now? You certainly can't rule it out. I don't want to be a total denialist here. But to have huge epidemics, many things have to come together and align to cause this huge mortality. And it's not clear to me that we are there yet. One of the things I've been so fascinated by, you know, the U.S. has had a relatively, a thankfully, small number of deaths so far, 36 deaths according to the Centers for Disease Control. And yet the country has been turned upside down. Mm. We obviously fear the death toll is going to increase, that we're still on the growth phase of this epidemic. But if you compare that to the tens of thousands of people who die each year from influenza, from alcohol, from firearms, let alone the 500,000 who die from heart disease or from cigarettes, you really have to wonder, why is it that some problems get an incredible attention as this one is, and some problems that are huge threats to our health are essentially ignored by comparison. Or the climate crisis would be another example.
David Jones, our time is up. I cannot thank you enough, all of you, for your work, your careers, your lives, your dedication, and joining us this evening. Megan Murray, David Jones, Arthur Kleinman, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
I am Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.